assault by the CIA. And it started here in the Bay of Pigs.
The CIA's actions in Cuba were designed to spark a popular revolution against Fidel, who'd come to power via a revolution himself. A revolution against American power in Cuba. This was a fight between the underdog Fidel Castro of Cuba and JFK of the all-powerful USA. Just why was the CIA so keen to invade a country as small as Cuba in the first place?
What could not be tolerated in Washington was a communist island 90 miles off Florida. This was just a non-starter.
As long as it existed, the US's control over the whole of Latin America was in question. So long as Castro was there, that challenge would persist.
People who are young today have got to understand what the Cold War meant. I mean, it was a terrifying 30 or 40 years in the life of the world.
Castro had not been in power more than 9 or 10 months before the CIA started writing memos and knocking on the door of the State Department saying, we have to develop a plan to overthrow this guy. He's uncontrollable, and the masses seem to respond to him in a way that we have never seen before.
The CIA, of course, came up with a plan. They came up with a bad plan, and the military harumphed at it because they knew how bad it was. And intelligence analysts weren't shown the plan because operational people weren't confident with the plan. But this is what the president wanted. So you had a very naive, overrated American president, I might add, in John F. Kennedy, going ahead with the Bay of Pigs, which was just destined to fail.
So just why was this operation destined to fail?
For all kinds of political reasons, American troops could not be seen to be invading Cuba. The political risks were far too high, including possible war with the USSR. So the CIA used Cuban mercenaries. Mercenaries are rotten soldiers. Mercenaries very, very rarely win. You know, they fight for money, they're fat, they're lazy, they're ill-disciplined, they don't know how to use a rifle.
These shots were filmed by enemies of Cuba. A handful of bandits has landed on Cuban soil.
The CIA put together a fighting force of 1,500 anti-communist Cuban exiles who lived in the United States. These weren't army men, but the CIA quickly trained and armed them and sent them off to fight against the professional Cuban army in the Bay of Pigs.
I think if you're looking at, you know, sort of small sort of paramilitary groups of less than 2,000, you know, taking on 35,000 sort of seasoned troops, well, it's a no-brainer. The fact is they're going to be killed. The CIA were sponsoring a Cuban fighting force as opposed to Americans. So if it's successful, American can wave its, you know, wave the flag and saying what a wonderful thing they've done. If it was unsuccessful, what you don't have is body bags coming back and being buried on everybody's TV screens in America in Arlington Cemetery.
The invasion was a total disaster. A, because they didn't know how to fight properly. B, because they kept landing in the wrong places. And C, because the people didn't rise up to help them.
They didn't understand Cuba at all. They didn't understand the nationalism of the revolution. And consequently, they had an operation which became known as a perfect failure. And in the end, it consolidated the Cuban revolution rather than completing its goal, which is to wipe Fidel Castro off the face of the map.
Cuba will never retreat. Cuba will hold out, our country or death.
It really was a total catastrophe and left Kennedy with egg all over his face.
Despite getting a beating at the Bay of Pigs, the CIA was still obsessed with getting rid of Fidel Castro. Over the next 10 years, in fact, they admitted to planning to bump him off no fewer than 8 times. But Castro was still there, and Cuba is still communist. Now, after failing to overturn communism in Cuba, across the other side of the world, in Indonesia, the CIA were trying to stop it taking root in the first place.
Indonesia was strategically important. It had a huge population, and the CIA believed their prime minister, Sukarno, was going to open up the country to communism.
The CIA was against Sukarno because he was too friendly towards the Communist Party in Indonesia. But he was not any kind of communist himself. He was not a communist dupe. But he was, to a certain extent, a Democrat, and he felt the communists had the right to be in the government. But that for Washington, that was much too much.
The CIA proposed a program of black operations, of covert propaganda, that was disseminated through Indonesian newspapers, through Indonesian political parties, through the Indonesian army, that attempted to raise the specter of a looming Indonesian Communist Party takeover of the Indonesian government.
The CIA made a bizarre decision. They tried to blacken Prime Minister Sukarno's name by making the world's first celebrity porn film. They hired a Sukarno lookalike and filmed him enjoying the company of a young lady who wasn't his wife. But the CIA failed to realize that Sukarno was already a famed womanizer, and this home movie had no impact at all on his popularity. So when this amusing attempt to get rid of him failed, the CIA turned to something a lot less funny. Black operations. Black operations are top secret or illegal missions which the CIA perform for the US government that aren't supposed to come out in the open.
Its more serious covert operations in Indonesia were aimed at doing something which was of much more questionable moral legitimacy, sowing confusion within Indonesian society so as to provoke an armed clash between the Indonesian army and the Indonesian Communist Party, which the CIA fully anticipated and hoped would result in a bloodbath and allow for a military takeover of the Indonesian government.
On the night of September 30th, 1965, a low-ranking soldier kidnapped and murdered six Indonesian generals. The soldier claimed he'd carried out this attack to prevent the generals taking over the country in a CIA-sponsored coup. In the confusion that followed these murders, General Suharto and his army blamed the Indonesian Communist Party and mounted a coup to get rid of Prime Minister Sukarno. The CIA had got what they wanted, and Sukarno was driven from power. After the coup, the CIA worked together with the generals to ensure every single communist in Indonesia was killed.
They gave the government of Indonesia a list of citizens who were communists, and this list was used by the government after the coup to start a massacre which took the lives of between 500,000 and a million people.
The United States government, led by the Central Intelligence Agency, helped to facilitate these massacres by providing various forms of communications equipment, money, and small weapons to the Indonesian army. This campaign constituted one of the greatest campaigns of slaughter in modern Asian history. I think, as a historian and as an American, that it is one of the most morally troubling episodes in the history of American foreign policy, and one which the U.S. government has never taken any responsibility for.
It's 1960, and another tiny country in Southeast Asia is about to be used by the CIA to prevent the spread of communism. This time, it's lucky Laos. Now, Laos is tucked away between Thailand and Vietnam. Most people would find it impossible to point out its borders, a problem that they'd share with the CIA, who decided that Laos was the key to winning the war in Vietnam. Laos had enormous strategic importance in the fight for Vietnam. The Vietnamese communists from the north had been using a secret trail which ran through Laos to direct troops, weapons, and supplies to fight the US troops in the south of Vietnam. The Americans couldn't invade Laos, so the CIA was called in and ordered to take care of the problem. In the hill villages of North Laos, the CIA spooks made contact with the ancient Hmong tribe.
30,000 of these fierce tribesmen were paid, trained, and signed up to fight for the CIA in this secret war in Laos. The tribesmen were happy to fight for the CIA, so long as they were allowed to carry on farming and selling their local cash crop, opium. Opium and heroin had always been grown and produced in Laos, but the CIA made it much easier for the tribesmen. Not only did the CIA let them carry on producing heroin, they also made it much easier for them. They set up an airline, Air America, which was used to transport the drugs into neighboring countries, including Vietnam.
I was a freelance journalist and I went to Laos to do this story on the source of the heroin and opium that was flooding into South Vietnam. And I was interviewing opium farmers. How much did you produce last year? What did you do with it? And the answers were always the same. We got about 5, maybe 10 kilos. At the end of harvest, we went down to that landing pad. An American helicopter came in, paid us cash for the opium, loaded the opium on the helicopter, and flew away.
I mean, the trail of drugs follows the trail of clandestine operations. And there's a very good reason for that. If you're carrying out clandestine operations, you need black money. And you need cooperation from criminals. All right. When you put together black money, untraceable money, and criminals, what does it add up to? Narco traffic.
CIA headquarters had no idea what was going on the ground in Laos. Their agents in Laos had to keep the local drug traffickers happy in return for their support. So the CIA got their secret army by turning a blind eye to the heroin trade. But what the CIA hadn't thought about was where this heroin was headed.
Well, it's what I call mission myopia, turning a blind eye, if you will. It was their troops, their aircraft, and they knew about it at the time. So the CIA was a part of that, and they were moral in that sense. They were loyal to their fighters. But they didn't worry about the fallout, what happened downstream. That was somebody else's business.
A huge quantity of the heroin produced by the tribesmen was delivered straight into the hands of the American GIs stationed in Vietnam.
In 1969, we adopted a defensive posture. The troops became demoralized. They were basically confined to fire bases in defensive positions, and time was very heavy on their hand. And the way to make 365 days just go blip and disappear was heroin. And the stuff was cheap. It was sold in every bar, every fire base, little tiny screw cap plastic vials, about $2 a piece. And it was 96% pure heroin. You didn't inject this stuff. You scooped it out and you snorted it. The White House did a survey after the Vietnam War. And they discovered that in 1971, one-third of all U.S. combat forces fighting in Vietnam were heroin addicts. If you do the calculus, okay, there were about 70,000 heroin addicts in the United States in 1969. By 1971, there were 80,000 heroin addicts in the U.S. Army fighting in South Vietnam. That means there were probably more American heroin addicts inside the U.S. Army in South Vietnam than there were in the United States.
So, by 1965, less than 20 years after its formation, the CIA had already got mixed up with heroin traffickers, overthrown governments in Asia and Africa, and tried to control people's minds. But there's more. After the break, I'll be flicking through more of the CIA's secret classified files to bring you revolution, murder, and an unlikely style icon.
It was a program of assassination.
We summarily executed more than 20,000 people.
Well, probably the best way to become an icon is to be assassinated by the CIA.
My name's Danny Wallace, and this is Secrets of the CIA. America has had a secret service since 1946, and throughout those years, it's been responsible for mayhem, murder, and revolution. Coming up, we uncover the CIA's secret assassination program responsible for tens of thousands of deaths. But first, let's take a look at how the CIA turned a man from Cuba into an icon by mistake. Che Guevara went straight to the top of the CIA's most wanted list after organizing the military side of the Cuban Revolution. He wanted to spread communism throughout Central America. The CIA wanted him stopped.
By 1967, Che and his band of guerrilla fighters were in the jungles of Bolivia. The USA had had enough. Che had to go.
The whole concept of guerrilla war was enshrined and symbolized, personified in Che Guevara. So long as he was free, so long as his reputation, which was always greater than his successes, continued to circulate, the idea of armed resistance to American imperialism continued as long as he lived.
The CIA was terrified of Che because he was obviously very popular. He was young, he was good looking, the girls liked him and so on, and he was fashionable. And suddenly communism wasn't sort of red in tooth and claw communism. It was, hey, Che Guevara, you know, could be the father of my baby. So the CIA decided it was time to get rid of Che, and they did their very best to assassinate him. In those days, CIA-sponsored assassinations, wet jobs, executive action, whatever you call it, were allowed. And they caught up with him eventually in Bolivia.
So the CIA came up with a plan to get rid of him. Felix Rodriguez, the CIA's main man in the hunt for Che Guevara, has admitted to ordering his assassination.
Guevara was finally picked up by a Bolivian ranger. Bear in mind, this was a highly trained counter-guerrilla force, trained by the Americans. And he was then taken to a small schoolhouse in La Higuera, where his presence was announced. And where there was, in particular, one man, Felix Rodriguez, who had been in Cuba, been at the Bay of Pigs, and is a figure who reappears constantly through the next 30 years of the CIA's history. He was in La Higuera. He claims, his account is, that he received a phone call instructing him to murder Guevara and authorize his killing by a local Bolivian sergeant. Che Guevara was murdered on October the 9th, 1967. In the minds of the CIA and the people around them, a dead Che would be one danger less, that he would be eliminated from the scene. To look around the world now in the beginning of the 21st century and see to what extent the image of Che Guevara has not only persisted, but has been picked up again precisely as a symbol of resistance, of anti-imperialism. You know, if they sought to kill off that idea, they failed.
Ironically, a dead Che Guevara became a much bigger problem for the CIA than the live one. Instead of dying away quietly, Che's face quickly became one of the most recognizable and iconic images in the world. And it still is today.
I think Che became an icon because he stood for something. And it was at a time where revolution was in the air in terms of how young people thought, and especially students. The company that I started, you know, Red or Dead, came out of the phrase better red than dead, and it was all of that time about young people thinking about revolution. Increasingly, there's a big industry behind Che. I remember a T-shirt out not so long ago with Jesus done in the same black and red with his crown of thorns, and look, you had to take a double take to see if it was a Che T-shirt, or if it was a picture of Jesus. But then, more overt than that, you know, you get Ricky Gervais, you get Madonna, you get Citizen Smith. You know, there's all these marketing departments and stylists saying, well, for this video, do a bit of Che, because, you know, it fits with the style of it, and it'll get you in the press on this and that, and it's a surefire winner.
I think the idea that Che Guevara represented a threat to Western democracy was complete balderdash. Here was an attractive man who spoke revolution, you know, smoked cigars, who wore those kind of sexy green fatigues, but he didn't represent a threat to the Western world. But in the warped mind of some CIA people, policymakers, they thought this man is potentially very dangerous. You know, he could inflame the young towards the idea of Marxist revolution.
Well, probably the best way to become an icon is to be assassinated by the CIA.
When the USA became involved in the Vietnam War, everyone in America was convinced that it'd be a short, easy war and that they'd quickly beat the communists.
But despite having much more money, guns and bombs, the Americans couldn't win the war in Vietnam. Their opponents in the Viet Cong didn't play by the rules. Instead, they perfected the rules of insurgent fighting still being used today in Iraq.
The Americans felt the need to hold the line, to proclaim to the rest of the world that the communists were not going to take over and that freedom and democracy of a sort would flourish. And I guess they believed it.
The enemy has turned more and more to the use of terror and murder as a way of maintaining his grip on the people, hoping to intimidate them into support as the voluntary support weakens.
Frustrated by the army's lack of success in Vietnam, President Lyndon Johnson turned to William Colby, the director of the CIA, for a top-secret answer to the Vietnam problem. The CIA's idea? Wet jobs. Using the Viet Cong's own tactics on itself and making lightning guerrilla raids to kill key Viet Cong leaders. It was called the Phoenix Program.
It was a program of assassination. Some of the strategies employed by Phoenix operatives might be to slit a potential Viet Cong, his throat in the night, throwing various suspected Viet Cong out of helicopters. You have two of them, you get one of them to talk by throwing the other one out of the helicopter to his death. Starving a suspected Viet Cong operative to death. A lot of procedures that, while they were excused at the time and in retrospect by people as being absolutely necessary, given the ugly nature of the conflict, I think it's easy to see why so many Americans were uncomfortable with this program and why it became a target for anti-war critics at the time.
I saw other interrogations to describe them briefly. The use of the insertion of a 6-inch dowel into the semicircular canal of one of my detainees' ears and the tapping through to the brain until he died.
My verdict on Phoenix would be no, it didn't work. It didn't work, first of all, because obviously the United States lost the war. The Viet Cong infrastructure was not eliminated. Even more than that, I think it turned many Vietnamese against the United States. When they saw the tactics being employed, either by Americans themselves or by South Vietnamese who were drawing their paychecks from the United States, I think it killed our image.
William Colby, the head of the CIA, later testified before the U.S. Congress that there were more than 20,000 extrajudicial executions done by the United States in the Phoenix program. That's to say, we summarily executed more than 20,000 people.
How many, roughly, would you estimate were eliminated?
Some 28,000 had been captured. Some 20,000 had been killed, and some 17,000 had actually rallied by that time. All the leaves are brown, leaves are brown, and the sky is gray, and the sky is gray.
The Phoenix program was a disaster on every single level. It horrified the American public and helped turn them against the war. And what's more, it simply didn't reduce the Viet Cong's military capability.
The prospect of a ceasefire hasn't made the position of the Vietnamese in the battle areas any easier. Indeed, it's made it much more difficult.
The impact of the Vietnam War on America was absolutely colossal. It was the one war that the Americans actually lost. And that was a huge shock to the system.
Whatever they'd done, it hadn't worked. The greatest military machine in the world was powerless to bring about a political solution. And I think that's one of the lessons of the late 20th, early 21st century, that war as we used to understand it doesn't achieve its objectives. Almost never does it achieve its objectives.
By 1970, the CIA had perfected the art of overthrowing democratically elected leaders. Iran, Congo and Indonesia had already fallen victim to CIA plots to depose and replace their prime ministers. Now the CIA turned its attentions to Chile, with devastating results.
In 1970,